And Brownie, you're doing a heck of a job. The FEMA director's working 24.
From Pacifica Radio's KPFK in sweltering Los Angeles, this is your broadcast. As heard on 90.7 FM in LA, 91.7 FM KYAQ on the beautiful Oregon Central Coast and coast to coast and around the globe on KPFK.org. 5 days a week on Radio Sputnik. I'm Brad Friedman. Your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you for joining us today. Well, it's been another big week, and of course, a lot of the attention last week was on Katrina and the 10th anniversary commemorations for that horrific flood in New Orleans. When some 1,800 people were, or more, I don't think we ever got a final tally. Did we, Desi Doyen, on the number of those killed in the
flood?
Funny
you should ask, because I have been looking everywhere, and I don't really see a consistent official tally. You know, some people say, oh, it's 1,200 people. Some, oh, no, it's 13. Other people say 15. The most consistent reports I have seen label it at about 1,800 people. Some people's bodies were never found. Some people never checked in. A lot of it has to do with how you compile it. So basically, it looks like overall, the Hurricane Katrina, the aftermath, about 1,800 people.
People are settling on that as the number, I guess. 1,800 gives you some idea about how well organized the response was, how much this the government, the Bush administration, the George W. Bush administration at the time actually gave a damn about what was going on. We can tell you sort of firsthand because 10 years ago, last week, we happened to be in Crawford, Texas. We were covering the uprising by Cindy Sheehan, whose son Casey Sheehan had been killed in Iraq in an ambush in a truck that he should have never been in. With no armor, a lot of people hopefully remember at the time, Donald Rumsfeld, you go to the war with the army you have, not with the army you want. And the fact was he should have never been there on this mission. But that's what we were doing for the first couple of years of the Iraq War. And so while everyone is sort of focusing on the 10th anniversary of Katrina, it's also the 10th anniversary of the uprising, as I like to refer to it, down in Crawford, Texas, when Cindy Sheehan, first in a ditch that she called Camp Casey as she was commemorating her son, decided to camp out essentially with the Veterans for Peace down there until she got an answer for George W. Bush as to what the noble cause was that her son had died for. Just days earlier, there was a bunch of folks from, I think, Ohio, a bunch of troops that were killed. And George W. Bush went out and said, well, they died for a noble cause. And Cindy Sheehan said, well, wait a minute, what noble cause? And she wanted an answer what the hell he was talking about. So we're going to talk a little bit about that because that happened in this very same week that Katrina rolled in. And a lot of people forgot what went on in Crawford, Texas, because really, and understandably, what happened in New Orleans 10 years ago, then took over the news cycle. And people forgot that prior to Cindy Sheehan's stand down there, we were living in a country where you did not criticize the president of the United States, not when we are at war, not after 9/11. Well, we happened to be down there. And I'll talk about that in a little bit. Des, remind me to talk about how we got down there, why we went down there in the first place. But we were down there. As the levees were breaking, we were in Crawford, Texas, where the president was hanging out with Karl Rove, who was out there backslapping supporters. And we've got photos at bradblog.com, backslapping supporters. Great to see you here. And these were people who had come out to protest against Cindy Sheehan's protest against the president 10 years ago. And it ended as that storm came into New Orleans, as Karl Rove was out there just having fun, not a care in the world, as people, some 1,800, were eventually dying from that. And we covered it on air as we had the first information from the National Weather Service about how bad this storm could be. So we went digging. We went digging into the archives, into the deep, deep, deep archives 10 years ago to find our broadcast, some of our clips from our broadcast down there in Crawford, Texas. We will share that with you as well. We will be covering the 10th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina on the Green News Report a little bit later. Also on the Green News Report, NASA is now warning that 3 feet of sea level is now locked in, no matter what we do, no matter what changes we make, no matter how much we move from fossil fuel to renewables. 3 feet of sea level rise is now locked in. I'm sure the folks in New Orleans, still recovering from Katrina, are not happy to hear that. And I'm sure the folks in Florida, who are now staring down the barrel of Hurricane Katrina, Hurricane Erica, actually Tropical Storm Erica
for
at this
now.
Time, right? Which may become a hurricane in the next few days. I'm sure they're delighted to hear that the sea level is going to rise 3 feet no matter what. President Obama heading to the Arctic amidst all of this. So a lot going on this week. We will be getting to all of that and more. But first, we talked a little bit on our last program about this letter that Bobby Jindal had sent to President Obama in advance of him coming to speak last week. Down in New Orleans to mark the 10th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. And Jindal said, please, but he didn't say please. He said, don't. He said, don't talk about climate change while you're here. That'll just be a distraction. And it's, what did he call it? The political agenda of liberal environmental activism, which is kind of incredible. In any event, he in this two-page letter that Bobby Jindal, governor of Louisiana and also ran 2016 presidential candidate on the Republican side, he also wrote to the president that, quote, New Orleans still bears the scars of the summer of 2005. But since then, we have experienced a Louisiana comeback. It has been a revival like no other in America. There are now more people living and working in Louisiana than at any other time in the state's history, earning higher incomes than ever before. A 25-year problem of out-migration has become a boom of in-migration of both people and employers, says Jindal. New Orleans has become a magnet for venture capital investment in its technology and media sectors. And then he went on to say, most importantly, with the New Orleans Recovery School District at its epicenter, our education system has been revolutionized. Charter schools and our scholarship program have given parents previously unthinkable choice and children unprecedented opportunity. That was from the letter from Bobby Jindal to the President of the United States in advance of his speaking in New Orleans last week on Friday. George W. Bush, some of you may remember him. He was also in New Orleans, and he spoke once again. He had spoken a year after the flood, but he spoke at the same school. He spoke again at the new Warren Easton Charter School in New Orleans. He spoke on Friday and praised that conversion that Bobby Jindal apparently was referring to, praised the conversion of the New Orleans public schools into a nearly 100% privately owned charter school system. Here, in case you forgot what he sounded like, is the former president, George W. Bush.
Long before the Great Flood, too many students in this city drifted from grade to grade without ever learning the skills needed for success. Parents lacked choices and the power to intervene. Principals and teachers lacked the authority to chart a more hopeful course. It was a system that stranded more than 60% of the students failing in schools. It was what I call the soft bigotry of low expectations. More than 9 in 10 public school students in this city now call our charter school home. And you got to ask why. It just didn't happen. Amazing what happened in this city after the storm wiped out the school system. Educational entrepreneurs decided to do something about the devastation and the failure. In other words, this isn't a theoretical exercise. It's important for our country to look at New Orleans and realize this is an exercise of implementing a plan which works.
That was former President George W. Bush on Friday in New Orleans at the Warren Easton Charter School. Well, in fact, according to Colleen Kimmett at In These Times, test scores have improved in New Orleans. That's according to two major reports that she writes about that examine academic achievement over the past 9 years. On Katrina's 10th anniversary, the New Orleans Recovery School District is being held up as a national model. The graduation rate has risen from 56% to 73%. Last year, 63% of students in grades 3 to 8 scored basic or above on standardized tests. That's up from 33%. So, is what George W. Bush and Bobby Jindal say is true? And do these test scores improving in Katrina? Is this a success story for charter schools? Is any of it true? Well, a 3-month investigation from the In These Times magazine by Colleen Kimmett suggests that the wholesale charterization of the public schools in New Orleans has actually been a failure. Joining us now to talk about that, freelance journalist Colleen Kimmett. Welcome to the broadcast, Colleen.
Thank you. Thanks. It's great to be here.
Glad to have you here. Okay, before we get into whether this system worked or didn't, can you explain for people who may not understand exactly what charter schools are? They're not exactly private schools, and they're not exactly public schools either, correct?
That's right. And in Louisiana and many other states, charter schools have to be run by a nonprofit board. They receive public tax dollars. They receive government and philanthropic grants. Mm-hmm. And they, in the recovery school district, are all open enrollment. So that means anyone can go. There's no admissions requirement. So to a parent, basically, it's a public school. It's a free school that has no admissions requirements. Unlike a traditional school, it's basically entirely autonomous. So the board of the charter can decide how long the school year is, how long the school days are, who the teachers are, and what the learning style of the school is as well.
So they don't have to meet the requirements of a public school district. They're funded like a public school, but where the public school district may have, teachers' unions and certain standards, specific standards that they say must be met and that, in fact, the school district oversees. Now you've got a private corporation essentially running these schools with public money, correct?
Yeah, non-profit corporations, that's correct. And there are some, basically the recovery school district acts more like a regulator. There are some rules that apply across the board, but they're basically free to run the school how they want.
And this all happened after the flood. Give us an idea of the numbers and the way that the system changed in New Orleans after the flood. How many schools are we talking about? Because, boy, Jindal and Bush are sure singing the praises of what happened down there in New Orleans. So was it a complete takeover by this recovery school district, which is, I guess, all essentially charter schools?
Yeah, it was a near complete takeover. And although the recovery school district was created by the state in 2003, it only had one school before Katrina. Then there was this huge storm. The public school district was in dire financial straits. And there was a new piece of legislation passed that basically broadened the pool of schools, academic economically unacceptable schools that could be taken over by the recovery school district. So we're talking 107 out of about 120 schools in New Orleans.
Okay, and so they're taken over, but test scores are way up. Attendance is way up, according to the – or graduation rates, I should say, is way up. Test scores are way up. Sounds good, Colleen Kimmett. What's the problem?
Well, yeah, I mean, test scores are up. Graduation rates are up. I mean, but also part of this transformation has also resulted in lawsuits filed by citizens for basically students not getting their rights. Also, fraud is not uncommon in this system.
Fraud, you say?
Yeah, there was a report released this year detailing at least 10 cases of fraud in the system. Mm-hmm. Another big report released this year.
Is that fraud by these private nonprofit companies that are running these school systems?
Exactly. For example, a recent one at an elementary school, the administrators took funding for special needs students, mm-hmm. but weren't providing those services.
You write in your report that the Louisiana charter school students performed worse on reading and math tests than their public school counterparts by enormous margins, 2 to 3 standard deviations after researchers, you know, controlled for factors like race, ethnicity, and poverty. The gap between charter and public school performance in Louisiana was the largest of any state in the country, and Louisiana has some of the worst scores in the country. Is the success, the supposed success of these charter schools, is it overstated? Is it a matter of manipulating the statistics? What does the public seem to be missing, if anything, according to your investigation?
To be honest, I think what the public is missing is that this obsession with test scores has a cost. That it's, you know, if what I heard from community members, students, and parents when I was in New Orleans, mm-hmm. is that they felt like they had lost schools as community assets. Mm. They felt like they had no say in the types of learning systems that were being implemented. And particularly in low-income minority communities like New Orleans, we see education take a no-excuses model. And these are the types of schools that are expanding most rapidly in New Orleans.
You referred to the no-excuses approach. Talk a little bit about that. You cite one group here that's involved in the RSD called the Collegiate Academies, one of several growing charter networks in New Orleans modeled on what's often referred to as the no excuses approach. What exactly is that no excuses approach?
Well, it's characterized by longer school days and longer school years, frequent testing and posting of grades in the classroom, mm-hmm. and in the hallways so students can see how they're doing compared to everyone else. The systems of demerits, mm-hmm. so that relatively minor infractions stack up against students until they get a detention or a suspension.
You write that the Psy Academy suspended 58% of its students, and that the two charters opened on this former Carver campus, Carver Prep and Carver Collegiate, suspended 61 to 69% of their students, respectively. So does this explain the higher graduation rate? If you just suspend these people or toss them out, might that explain the differences in the numbers?
Well, there are certainly are researchers who are asking those questions and raising concerns about the fact that because charter schools need to be audited for this information, it's not always readily available. And so it is possible that students are slipping through the cracks. There's also been a lot of turmoil within the system over the past 10 years because if schools don't achieve academic targets, they get closed down. And that's happened at least 10 times that I'm aware of. So that means the teachers find new jobs, the students have to find new schools. And so there's concerns that in those kinds of transitions, students can get lost as well.
And I know a lot of teachers left after the flood. You write in your report that in these times, in a school system with an 87% African-American student body, parents and students are challenging the change in the demographics of the teaching force. It is now only 54% African-American. It is down from 73% African-American, the teaching force prior to Hurricane Katrina. And you also cite a key point from Naomi Klein and her book, her 2007 book, The Shock Doctrine. In sharp contrast to the glacial pace with which the levees were repaired and the electricity grid brought back online after the flood, the auctioning off of New Orleans school system took place with military speed and precision. She holds this up as a prime example of, quote, disaster capitalism, orchestrated raids on the public sphere in the wake of catastrophic events combined with the treatment of disasters as exciting market opportunities. It's an amazing report, Colleen, and folks can go on over to inthesetimes.com to read it if you'd like sort of a counterbalance to a lot of the, well, to the impression that folks like George W. Bush and Bobby Jindal are putting out there on the 10th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. We get to hear in your report from a lot of teachers, students, administrators, and so forth about those concerns to help us get a slightly more balanced outlook on what happened after Katrina. Colleen, really appreciate your time with us today and appreciate your investigative report over at In These Times.
Thank you, and thanks for the opportunity to talk about it. And thanks also to the Fund for Investigative Journalism for supporting my...
Smartly done. My thanks to them as well. Thanks, Colleen.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and we will be back with more broadcast remembrances of Katrina and remembrances of Cindy Sheehan's uprising in Crawford, Texas, 10 years ago. We were there. Stay tuned. This is your broadcast. Hey, it's Brad, and you're listening to the broadcast on Radio Sputnik. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com here with you. 10 years after not just Hurricane Katrina rolled into New Orleans, but Hurricane Cindy Sheehan rolled into Crawford, Texas. And we happened to be there at the time covering it. Cindy Sheehan, of course, is the peace activist, the anti-war activist, the Gold Star mother. Who stood up and demanded a meeting with President George W. Bush, or at least tried to. She wondered what that noble cause was that George W. Bush had said her son had died for. Actually, he wasn't speaking about her son. He was talking about eight Marines who had been killed just days earlier. And he said they had died for a noble cause. And Cindy Sheehan's son, Casey Sheehan, he had been killed earlier. He had been killed in 2004, I believe it was. And in August of 2005, after George W. Bush made his comments, she wanted to know, what is this noble cause? And she made her stand, and it attracted the attention of not just the country, but frankly, the world and thousands of people. Now, I happened to be at the time I was camping in the mountains, and I made the horrible mistake of turning on a radio. I had one of these old crank radios that, you know, crank it up, doesn't require electricity. And I heard Rush Limbaugh talking about Cindy Sheehan. And I knew who Cindy Sheehan was because I had interviewed, as I like to say, I interviewed Cindy Sheehan before she became Cindy Sheehan. She had testified a few weeks earlier at a hearing in the basement of the U.S. Capitol held by John Conyers and others looking into the lead up to the Iraq War at the time. And the Republicans who were controlling the U.S. House would not even allow John Conyers and the Democrats a meeting room in which to have oversight about what happened to lead us into the Iraq war. So the Democrats had to open up a hearing room in the basement. It was pretty much a broom closet that they had to open up and have a hearing to discuss why we went to war. The false reasons, frankly, that we went to war. And Cindy Sheehan was one of the people who had testified in those basement hearings. So I knew who she was. And so when I heard Rush Limbaugh going on the air and saying all kinds of just terrible things about her, that she was a Democratic operative, that she was, that she was supporting Al-Qaeda, that how dare she speak up against George W. Bush, because it was at a time when nobody, when you just were not allowed to speak out against the president of the United States. Anyone who did, it was huge headlines when that happened. Because, after all, we were at war. Never mind the fact that, you know, now we're still at war all over the world. But apparently that idea about criticizing the president, that doesn't hold when it's a Democratic president in the White House. But back then, it was a Republican president in the White House, and he was not to be criticized. And so instead, they went after Cindy Sheehan, and they went after her hard. And that was a long, hot summer, but it represented, I think, a turning point in the Bush presidency, from the time when you weren't supposed to criticize him to a time when everybody criticized him when his failures were just laid bare. And it was in part Cindy Sheehan down there in Crawford, Texas, in August of 2005, late August, a sweltering late August, just like this August. But it was Cindy Sheehan. And then if there was any doubt about George W. Bush's incompetence, that was all wiped away as Katrina rolled ashore down on the Gulf Coast and into New Orleans, where 1,800 people, or that's our best guess, were killed. So I was up there. As I said, I was camping. I heard Rush Limbaugh, and I said, oh, man, I got to get down to Crawford, Texas. I got to tell the truth about what is actually going on. And Desi, I remember at the time, you said, how are we going to get on the air?
Yeah, that's a field. That's the middle of the rural countryside out in Texas.
Yeah,
how are we
going to
do it?
Middle of a cow pasture. How are we going to do it? That was before ubiquitous internet and 4G and everything else. And I said, well, I don't know. We were camping up in northern Nevada. Yeah. I don't know, but we've got about 20-something hour drive down there to figure it out on the way. And we got down there, and our friend Odie McClay, he wasn't a friend at the time, we didn't know him. He was from the Pacifica Station down in Houston, KPFT. He said, I don't know how to get you on the air either, but if there's any shred of internet, we'll try to do it. I'll meet you there. And he met us there at Camp Casey, where the Veterans for Peace, who were down there supporting Cindy Sheehan, where they had figured out how somehow to rig internet in the middle of this cow pasture.
When we say cow pasture, literally.
Literally, a cow pasture.
Right,
yeah.
Next to a farm-to-market road, which is, you know, only listed by a number. That's how far out of town it was.
And they had set up this tent, this huge tent. Originally, Cindy Sheehan had camped in the gutter on the side of the road, and then she was moved out of there by George W. Bush's pals in the Crawford police. And someone down there, a property owner, instead of tossing her out of town, property owner said, well, you can come do it here on this corner of my ranch. And she did. And it got a lot of coverage, of course, at the time from the major cable networks, whoever they were at the time. Pretty much CNN, I think, was just about it. I can't remember if Fox News was
they
Fox
eventually
News there.
Came down. Yes.
But they covered it. But they would do it, you know, quick hits. They covered it at the top of the hour, whatever. We were down there talking to the people on the ground, talking to Cindy Sheehan, interviewing people who had come from all over the country, frankly, both to support Cindy Sheehan and to protest Cindy Sheehan. And I think we did about 50 hours of coverage from on the ground in Camp Casey at the time. And Desi, I know you've been digging around in the archives this week to find some of that coverage, and I don't know how we got on the air, but we did. And here was, I think you pulled a bit of a rant of me, and before we get to the to the Katrina stuff that happened down there. A bit of a rant from me talking about
yes, this was after you had heard Rush Limbaugh originally attacking her.
Yeah.
And then as the protests grew, the anti-war protests grew and more people came down there and spoke out about their feelings about the war, Rush Limbaugh at the time took the opportunity to really smear Cindy Sheehan as much as he could every single day on his program. And this is what you had to say in response.
A bit of a response to my good friend Rush Limbaugh from down in Crawford, Texas, 10 years ago.
The only broadcast organization to be down here on the ground, live, every day, getting out the truth from the ground at Camp Casey, at the Crawford Peace House. And I can tell you, the folks that I'm talking to, the Gold Star mothers that I'm talking to, who have given the lives of their children, the vets, the troops who are out here, who have given their lives to fight for this country, for your war, you're going to question the patriotism of these people? Are you kidding me? Now, you may disagree with Cindy Sheehan. That's fine. But when you start questioning the patriotism of the people who are brave enough to come down here, put their lives aside, and stand with Cindy Sheehan in 100-plus degrees heat because they want to simply know what the hell is the noble cause that you have sent their sons and daughters to fight and die for. You call it democracy and freedom. Fine, sir. But that's not what you called it 3 years ago. 3 years ago, when you invoked the War Powers Act, when you asked Congress to invoke the War Powers Act, you said they needed to do so because they had to fight back at Saddam, because Saddam Hussein was involved with Al-Qaeda, and because Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. Well, sir, the 9/11 Commission report came out and showed that Saddam was not involved with 9/11. The Charles Dulfer report came out and showed that Saddam did not have WMD. Now, I've spoken with some Bush supporters out here who are still insisting that Saddam had WMD.
Of course they were. And there are still, that was me in Crawford, Texas, on the ground at the Cindy Sheehan uprising back in 2005, 10 years ago, this weekend, actually. Thanks for pulling that, Des. Boy, you could tell how hot it was just by hearing my voice, actually. It was so hot. It was literally, I remember
100 degrees in the shade.
Yeah, 110 degrees. I know you say 100. I remember.
Well, that was in the shade.
In the shade. That's how hot it was down there. And
I took the thermometer out to the cow pasture.
And it was like the Woodstock, frankly, for a generation of Americans who had been sick and tired of, you know, being told that George W. Bush is our great leader. And they were finally able to stay, to stand up. And people came from all over. And we interviewed Joan Baez. And
she sang every night.
She sang. She did private concerts down there. Not private, but concerts for the people who were there. Martin Sheen was there. All kinds of people came through there. It was remarkable to be there, and it made the difference. And I believe it was the turning point. Even had Hurricane Katrina not blown in, everything had changed after that. And by the way, we wanted to have Cindy on the show today. She has a very ill family member that she is taking care of. She was actually going to be on a plane flying out there to take care of her. So our best wishes to Cindy Sheehan and to her sister. So she was not able to be here. But looking back and looking at what, you know, Cindy has done since, the books she's written, it's hysterical to me that they were saying that Cindy Sheehan is a stooge of the Democrats. I mean, she has continued to fight for peace and freedom. She has been arrested at the White House protesting Barack Obama. I think her newest book is something like The Obama Files, the award-winning war criminal. So, you know, the idea that she was out there somehow working for Democrats instead of standing up for peace and standing up for the right thing and standing up against the lies of George W. Bush is as appalling today as it was then. It was disgusting. It was disgusting hearing Rush Limbaugh attack her the way he did and everyone on the right, you know, and it was equally disgusting. Seeing what happened in the days after Katrina came ashore and after the levees were breached in New Orleans, Because we were still in Crawford. George W. Bush was still in Crawford at his ranch on vacation as people were dying in New Orleans. But before that happened, we got a notice. Somehow, as I said, somehow we were able to stay on the we were able to get internet at the time, and people were picking us up from all over, Air America and Pacifica Radio. Actually, I think it was Air America said, "How the hell are you on the air down there, Brad, in the middle of that cow pasture?" I said, "You know what? Come down and find out. And you should be broadcasting here, Air America." That was the progressive station that, you know, should have been there around the clock. And eventually they did. And we ended
with
up
our help.
Yes, with our help. And we ended up simulcasting with them. In any event, somehow we had internet. We had huge listenership. We were on a whole bunch of stations and networks all over the country because people were hungry to know what was actually going on. And at some point, as the protests were wrapping up, because it was the end, supposed to be the end of George W. Bush's vacation, at some point I got an email from someone warning about this hurricane, Hurricane Katrina, that was heading towards New Orleans. And we all knew that it was obviously it was coming. It took days to get there. But we didn't understand the size of this hurricane, just how bad it was going to be. And when I got this message from the National Weather that somebody had forwarded me from the National Weather Service, I didn't even want to read it on air because I thought it was a hoax. And we went to a break, and I was able to go to the National Weather Service and confirm that it was true. This is the moment that we went on air with this. Still today, I've never seen anything like this from the National Weather Service. This warning about Katrina, as I was actually trying to downplay it a little bit on the air because it seemed so extreme at the time. 10 years ago, this weekend in Crawford, Texas, from the Camp Casey, here is our warning about Hurricane Katrina coming ashore.
But this is what's really scary. When I got this... And, oh, shoot, forgive me, whoever it was who gave it to me originally, Fancy Pants Elitist, I think, was the first one who sent it to us here from the blog at bradblog.com. And I didn't believe that this could be true. It's actually from the National Weather Service. A most powerful hurricane with unprecedented strength, jeez, rivaling the intensity of Hurricane Camille of 69.
Oh, my.
Most of the area will be uninhabitable for weeks, perhaps longer. At least one half of well-constructed homes will have roof and wall failure. All gabled roofs will fail, leaving those homes severely damaged or destroyed. The majority of industrial buildings will become non-functional. Partial to complete wall and roof failure is expected. All wood-framed low-rising apartment buildings will be destroyed.
Oh, my.
Concrete block. Low-rise apartments will sustain major damage, including some wall and roof failure. High-rise office and apartment buildings will sway dangerously, a few to the point of total collapse. Oh. All windows will be blown out.
It's a five?
No, it is currently
happening
a five.
Now.
Oh, and we'll try to find out when.
Have you been to New Orleans?
No,
I was born
subterranean.
There.
Whoa.
Well, it's not subterranean. The water table's really high, so it's basically there's certain parts of it that are actually below sea level.
Mm-hmm.
And so whenever there's a storm, it floods quite a bit. And you can see when you're in New Orleans, in certain parts of the city, they actually bury everyone in crypts that are above the street.
Wow.
That was, prophetic, Desi Doyen. That was was you talking about the sea level.
The and topography.
How low it was. Yeah. That was with, who is that? Alaska Girl.
Karen Turpening.
Ah, Karen Turpening, a photographer who had come down there, who happened to be on the air with us when that.
She came from Alaska.
Most of the area will be uninhabitable. All apartments will be destroyed. And I was really, hearing it again, I was trying to downplay it because I didn't want to cause a panic. And because I thought surely someone at the National Weather Service must have been overstating what was to come.
And they were not.
And they were not, indeed. And as we know, things just the next day we had actually it was our last day on the air was our last day. We thought that like much of the country, we thought a bullet had been dodged. The storm had weakened as it came ashore, but that was before the levees broke. And at the very same time, there were supporters out there actually opponents of Cindy Sheehan who had been protesting there for weeks, protesting Cindy Sheehan's protest. And I remember Karl Rove came out in a white pickup truck because he had been there, of course, with the president. And he was out there backslapping and thanking these anti-Cindy Sheehan supporters on the road. Again, we've got pictures over at bradblog.com. But he was, just having the time of his life. And, of course, I didn't know that the levees had breached by then. But, in fact, they had been breached by then. And George W. Bush's top political advisor, top advisor, was out there just laughing and having fun and having a great time as people were dying in the streets of New Orleans. And after we left, I remember one of the first things, and we ran this also at Brad Blog, David Edwards, who's now over at Raw Story, but he was our video guy, and he ran this remarkable interview with Jefferson Parish President Aaron Broussard on Meet the Press. Just days after all of this had happened. And it's one of the clips that I haven't seen, as people have been talking about Katrina over the past week. But it was remarkable. And here's a clip from that Meet the Press, the very beginning of September 2005, 10 years ago.
But I want to thank Governor Blanco for all she's done and all her leadership. She sent in the National Guard. I just repaired a breach on my side of the 17th Street Canal that the secretary didn't foresee, a 300-foot breach. I just completed it yesterday with convoys of National Guard and local parish workers and levee board people. It took us 2.5 days working 24/7. I just closed it. Wow. I'm telling you. Most importantly, I want to thank my public employees that have worked 24/7. They're burnt out, the doctors, the nurses. And I want to give you one last story, and I'll shut up and let you tell me whatever you want to tell me. The guy who runs this building I'm in, emergency management, he's responsible for everything. His mother was trapped in St. Bernard Nursing Home. And every day she called him and said, are you coming, son? Is somebody coming? And she said, yeah, mama, somebody's coming to get you. Somebody's coming to get you on Tuesday. Somebody's coming to get you on Wednesday. Somebody's coming to get you on Thursday. Somebody's coming to get you on Friday. And she drowned Friday night. She drowned Friday night.
Mr. President.
Nobody's coming to get us. Nobody's coming to get us. The secretary has promised. Everybody's promised. They've had press conferences. I'm sick of the press conferences. For God's sakes, shut up and send us somebody.
That was Jefferson Parish President Aaron Broussard back in September, very beginning of September in 2005, 10 years ago. And we were in Crawford with George W. Bush, who clearly, he loves to say we were unprepared. We had no idea. No idea the levees would break. Is that true?
That's not true.
They knew. They had warnings. This had been...
numerous warnings over many years that the levees were not being kept up properly, that the levees were not properly designed, the levees were not properly constructed or maintained. You know, it's all been found in the years since that the Army Corps of Engineers failed. And, what happened. I have no words, really. No words.
And it was just incredible to see George W. Bush down there. Late last week in Crawford, not in Crawford, in New Orleans, celebrating how far they've come and what a great success their newly privatized school system is now that the Great Flood came in and completely wiped out the old one. And hey, isn't it great? Now it's all replaced by corporations. Anyway, 10 years ago, and I just wanted to remind people about what Cindy Sheehan did that same week, that same month. Because a lot of it just got lost, understandably, with Hurricane Katrina. But to me, frankly, she's an American hero. I don't care what you think about her. I saw firsthand the courage that she needed to stand up down there to the George W. Bush machine and say, this is wrong. This is just wrong. We have been lied to. We were lied into war. And everything since then has shown that she was right. A quick break, and we'll be back with the Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman. Hey, this is Brad, and you're listening to the Bradcast on Radio Sputnik.
How about your son?
How about your daughter? How come it's always poor folk who get shuffled off to slaughter? If you're so gung-ho, why don't you just go? In August of 05, a mighty voice did rise. She lost her precious son, and it can't be undone. She went to see the king, a downright simple thing. She thought she'd tell him of the death of a mother's love. How about your son? How about your daughter? How come it's always poor folk who get shuffled off to slaughter? If you're so gung-ho, why don't you just go and send us back our sons and our daughters? Send us back our sons and our daughters.
Welcome back to the Bradcast. 10th anniversary of both Hurricane Katrina and Cindy Sheehan's Camp Casey uprising, her demand to meet the president and ask what was the noble cause for which her son died. That was Jesse Dien. Who on our broadcast 10 years ago from Camp Casey, and this was actually the day after Hurricane Katrina had come ashore. It was our last day, and that was a song that he wrote, Jesse Dien, for Cindy Sheehan. And I remember as he was singing at the winds from Hurricane Katrina, because we were in Crawford, Texas, not far away, came blowing in the middle of him performing this song. And All the veterans came up and they held up trash can lids.
Blankets.
To try to keep the wind off.
Shield him from the wind.
So he could continue the song. Just amazing. 10 years later. Yeah, what led to all of this? Not the war, but the Katrina. Well, global warming, as you discuss, Desi Doyen, in our latest Green News Report.
It is just mind-boggling to watch this happening.
A lot of flooding all over the city.
Buildings have collapsed. There are reports from New Orleans of people trapped in buildings. But there could be far worse still to come.
The 10th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina.
And it's very likely to get worse in the future.
NASA warns at least 3 feet of sea level rise now locked in. Obama heads to the Arctic to highlight global warming. Plus,
it's got so many benefits and so little downside. Why would you not do that?
Switching to clean energy will cost less than fossil fuels in the long run, says Citibank.
All of those stories and more straight ahead from bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
There is no perfect source of energy. Every one of them has a downside. Solar is great, but solar takes huge amounts of water.
Oh, Carly Fiorina, you are darling. This is your Green News Report.
I'm gonna soak up the sun.
Okay, Desi Doyen, I remember it like it was yesterday, unfortunately. The day that Hurricane Katrina came ashore 10 years ago.
Yes, Hurricane Katrina was the powerful hurricane that wrought devastation across much of the Gulf Coast, but drowned the city of New Orleans. Back in 2005, we were broadcasting live from the anti-war protests at the Bush Ranch in Crawford, Texas, when the frightening National Weather Service alert came across the wires.
It's actually from the National Weather Service. A most powerful hurricane with unprecedented strength, rivaling the intensity of Hurricane Camille of 69.
Oh, my.
Most of the area will be uninhabitable for weeks.
Katrina's ferocity was the first that many in the public had ever heard of global warming. But the real cause of the devastation was the oil and gas industry's decades-long destruction of Louisiana's storm-buffering wetlands, plus the shoddy levee system built by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to hold back the ocean, created the conditions that allowed Katrina's storm surge to flood the city, killing an estimated 1,800 people. Hurricane Katrina changed the face of New Orleans forever. The costliest hurricane yet in the U.S. Its heartbreaking aftermath exposed our nation's deep vulnerability to disasters. Resilience to the accelerating impacts of global warming is also the core message of what the White House is labeling President Obama's climate change tour. After skewering the oil industry for its anti-free market efforts to kill clean energy in Nevada, and then commemorating Katrina's devastation in New Orleans, Obama goes to the Arctic Circle, the first sitting American president to do so. The goal of the trip is to help Americans and the corporate news media confront the fact that climate change is not some distant threat, but is impacting Americans right now.
You know, it'd be a hell of a lot easier for the president to do that had he just not given the final approval to Shell Oil to drill in that very same Arctic.
Obama will be visiting coastal villages in Alaska that are having to relocate away from the surging ocean, even while the permafrost melts beneath them. Now, some impacts are unavoidable. NASA confirms that sea level rise continues to accelerate thanks to global warming. Moreover, in this study, they say, quote, it is pretty certain we're locked into at least 3 feet of sea level rise and probably more. In other words, they say it's not a question of if, but when.
Well, when? Do they give a timeline for any of this?
They don't. They say they don't have the data yet to be able to estimate when this will all happen. They said it could be 100 years. It could be less. Meanwhile, a new economic report finds that the cost of moving to clean energy would be cheaper than our current fossil fuel-based economy. The detailed economic analysis from banking giant Citigroup finds that over the next 30 years, the cost of transitioning to clean energy is about the same as what the world would have spent on fossil fuels anyway over the same period of time.
Oh, those lefty tree huggers at Citibank.
And they say we would save billions, if not trillions, of dollars avoiding the risk of disasters from global warming impacts. On the broadcast, environmental journalist David Roberts of Vox.com said the Citigroup researchers were so stunned by their results, they concluded their report with a simple question.
Do you do the same thing you're doing at enormous risk, or do you take this alternative route, which costs about the same and avoids this enormous risk? They basically say, like, why would you not do this? Like, it's got so many benefits and so little downside. Why would you not do that?
Why would you not do that? Hey, Citibank, have you met what has become of the U.S. Congress? For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. You can download our reports anytime via iTunes. Find us and follow us on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. From bradblog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Do you know what it means to miss New Orleans and miss it each night and day? I know I'm not wrong. The feeling's getting stronger the longer I stay.
Indeed. Well, my thanks to you, Desi Doyen, our producer, for digging back into the archives for today's program 10 years ago.
Yeah, it's a lot to cover.
Yeah, and a great Green News Report there. Very important one. So thank you, Desi Doyen, our producer. Thanks to our booking goddess, Cynthia Cohn. Thanks to Colleen Kimmett of InThesetimes.com. And as long as I'm at it, my thanks to Cindy Sheehan and Jesse Dian. Anything else, Des?
No, that's it.
All right. If you missed any portion of today's broadcast, you can download it all at bradblog.com or over at iTunes, where we hope you'll subscribe for free. And give us a good review while you're there to help help other folks find the broadcast a little bit easier. Drop me email. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. And, of course, find and follow me on the Facebooks and the Twitters at The Brad Blog. I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
Jackson.